trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter in a bright, beautiful, sunny Davis day. Don, it is gorgeous. And yesterday it wasn't terribly hot. Yeah, are we going to go back to normal?
No, we're going to go way below normal. First of all,
because we were up. We were high.
We were briefly. Yes, we were high briefly. You usually start with it's a bright, beautiful, sunny day here in Northern California. But I'm looking out the window and there's cloud cover here in Solano County and there are clouds moving in. It is presently, first of all, thanks to the customer years ago who reminded us to state the date at the beginning of the program. We are recording this on August 12th. 2026 for broadcast on August 13th, 2026. And the temperature at the University Airport in Davis right now is 70 degrees and 60% humidity. But what really matters...
At what time?
I don't know. What is it? Noon? No, 10 in the morning.
It's 9:47, actually.
Going up to a high today of 88 degrees, which
is going
to be the highest temperature in the next week.
Wow.
And that's by the time the show broadcasts, we will have gone through increasing clouds, 58 degrees overnight, 79 degrees on Thursday, 55 degrees Thursday night, 78 degrees on Friday. These are the Davis numbers. You'll get slightly different numbers for Sacramento, Woodland, Dixon, but somewhere in the 78 to 80 degree range. Friday night, 54 degrees. Saturday, 82 degrees. Nursery managers, order up. Saturday night, 55 degrees. Sunday, 86 degrees. Sunday night, 56. Monday, 85. Monday night, 57. Tuesday, 85. So basically 78 to 85 degrees for the next 7 days. This is August.
It's the middle of August.
It
shouldn't be like that, should it?
We're about 6 or 7 degrees below average with those types of temperatures. Night temperatures are just somewhat below average. It's going to be very balmy, very pleasant, partly cloudy at times. We do have some risk of storms and such, not here, but over in the foothills and in the coast range. So what's happening is that the upper level trough has settled over the region on Wednesday. Today, monsoon moisture is pushing in along the east side, especially bringing an increased chance of thunderstorms Wednesday and Thursday, day of the broadcast, especially along the Sierra foothill and the crest. And the concern is that some of these will be dry lightning and some of them will be wet storms. And so there's a possibility for new fire starts, but also moisture could put them out pretty quickly. Hard to say. There are some concerns about that. There will be notably cooler temperatures across interior Northern California Thursday and Friday. Highs in the 80s across the interior valley, mid-90s and mid-80s for the foothills. 60s, highs in the 60s up in the mountains. Then monsoon moisture will gradually push back out of the area after Friday. Thunderstorm chances begin to decrease to 10% or less along the Sierra crest. So some possibility of that on the other side of the valley. We're going to have here is substantially cooler than average temperatures for the next several days, which is absolutely delightful from a gardening standpoint. Strong onshore flow, that is coastal breeze, sea breeze pushing in substantially. Last evening, as early as actually about 6 p.m., it was pushing in hard out here in Solano County. Temperatures were dropping very rapidly, and that's been the pattern, coming in earlier than normal. This is something I would tell my staff years ago, that if it's closing time in Davis and you want to see whether we're going to cool off and get a delta breeze, go online and look at the temperature and the wind speed in Fairfield, because Fairfield is about 30 miles west of Davis. And if the wind speed is 10 to 15 miles an hour or higher, which it very commonly is there, and the temperatures are substantially cooler, that's a delta breeze already on its way. If the temperature in Fairfield at the time we close, 5:30 or so, is the same as Davis, the delta breeze is going to be substantially later since it hasn't even begun the trek into the valley. We're getting that onshore flow very strongly every evening, and it's going to be real strong for the next week. What this means is you have fantastic transplanting weather. We couldn't
but be the better. Tomatoes are still going to be setting because it's not too hot.
Yeah, the tomatoes are setting very well, and we've had a great year for fruit set on almost all the tomato varieties because we've had so many days where we barely got above 90, and that's kind of an important temperature threshold for a lot of varieties. Tomatoes continuing to set, tomatoes continuing to ripen. Some sunburn on the fruit. We talked about that last week. It wasn't severe, but hopefully you were able to grab the few fruit that were exposed to the western sun, get them inside to continue the ripening on the table. And I actually, slight digression here, I do a count sometime in the first 1 to 2 weeks of August. I do a quick count of the fruit set and estimate of what I've picked already from certain varieties. Now, I haven't gotten all the way through, but the three that really impressed me, Early Girl, Early Girl Plus, which has just been bred for greater disease resistance, and New Girl. I wanted to try them all side by side. So 1, 2, 3, right in a row, same irrigation, basically planted at the same time. Plants pretty much looked the same. Did a quick count yesterday evening. Each plant has approximately 75 fruit on it.
Wow.
3 tomatoes. And it occurred to me, for the average family, you know, 225 fruit over about an 8-week period would probably be enough tomatoes for one season. You'd have fresh fruit every day. You'd have enough to, you know, make some salsa and sauce and put it by. So 3
and invite your neighbors over.
Yeah, there you might need an extra one for your neighbors, but sure, you know, you're close. So this is what was on the plant. Bear in mind, this is August. We've already picked probably a couple dozen off of each of these plants, and the turkeys have had, you know, 5 or 10 off of each of them. So I'm just conservative estimate. 3 plants, the girls, as we like to call them, Early Girl, Early Girl Plus, New Girl, all virtually identical with respect to vigor, yield, fruit quality, everything. As far as I can tell, they're practically the same. And 75 fruit on each one of them, which will be, they're in stages ranging from the size of a nickel. They're still in the cell division stage. Many that are expanding and some that are turning color right now that I'll be picking later today. So I'll be picking off of those plants for the next 4 to 6 weeks. And this is the third week of August. So we'll be picking from them right on through September. For a lot of people, that would be enough tomatoes. And so if you're trying to figure out how many to plant each year, you choose a reliable variety like Early Girl or New Girl or one of the newer variants of Early Girl. 2 or 3 of those would give you plenty of fruit. And we're talking typically 4 to 6 ounce fruit. So big enough for slicing, but not huge. And they ripen quickly. Really good flavor. Early Girl is always considered one of the best flavored tomatoes. And New Girl has the exact same flavor profile. Either one of them would be fine. As I said, 225 fruit on 3 vines. I haven't even gotten down the rest of the row. Champion and some of the others are probably going to give them a run for their money. But I will say these were the first we were picking. They were the first to ripen, and they continued to set longer than usual this year because we had such nice mild weather right on through July. So perhaps a more typical year would be 50 per plant. Okay, that's pretty good. Considering I haven't done anything particularly special for these, might be enough tomatoes. Having said that all about summer vegetables, I will say we always tell you by the calendar, this is a great time to plant brassicas to start planting your cool season vegetables. Normally, though, when we're saying that in August, it's 100 degrees. It's not very comfortable for you to be out there. It's okay for the plants, but you're not very happy to be out there. And, you know, the little seedlings may stress a little bit when it's 100 degrees and north wind is blowing and fairly typical August weather. This is perfect. And
tell me again, which ones are the brassicas?
Oh, that's the term we use for everything in the mustard family. So it includes broccoli, cauliflower, and these are the important ones. Brussels sprouts, which really should have gone in July, but you're okay with August planting. Romanesco, which is a cauliflower, but it resembles a broccoli in the way we grow it and use it. Collards, kale, and of course, the leafy greens, mustards, bok choy, things like that. Now, some of those, if you put them in August, they're just going to flower right away. Bok choy is a good example. People use it when it's coming into flower, so that's okay, but it flowers very quickly in high temperatures and long days. So it's just going to, it'll be a quick crop. But the things like the broccoli, there are modern hybrids that we all sell that will produce pretty quickly. But the old-fashioned ones with the bigger heads, this is true for the old-fashioned cauliflower, definitely the case for Romanesco and for Brussels sprouts. They need a big plant to sustain the big head. First of all, give them plenty of room. When I would plant broccoli and cauliflower out, I used to space them 12 to 18 inches apart. That's too close. Too close for old-fashioned types. It's okay for the modern ones that are developed for that particular purpose, actually. But for older fashion, larger headed types of broccoli, they should have at least 18 inches. 24 inches would be better. Romanesco, 24 to 36 inches, because they will get big. If you have the room, they're definitely worth growing. They're very cool and very interesting. The flower pattern with the Fibonacci pattern to it, and the, you know, the fractal arrangement of the inflorescence. That's cool. And they are very delicious and easy to grow, but they do need space. And old fashioned cabbage, and also Napa cabbage, which is really popular, quite easy to grow. Each plant needs 2 to 3 feet. So that's the first thing. If you can get them in early enough and get those plants off to a good start, the young plants don't mind the heat. They don't mind the long days. You don't have to worry about that. They're called cool season plants because of when they produce, but they don't have to go into cooler soil. They don't have to be shaded or any of that. They go in just fine. You will need to water daily. So these need to go in a place where you're turning your system on every day, or you're going to hand water the young seedlings to get them established. They love a light feeding as they're getting going to get the plants off to a vigorous start. And you want to focus on growth for the first 4 to 6 weeks. So light feeding with fish emulsion, something like that. Plenty of water. And keep an eye out for the particular pests that come on with the brassicas, especially when you plant them early. But this is a great time to get going if you have space in your garden to, you know, maybe take out that one tomato that didn't do well, or that your corn is done or whatever. Here's the thought, had enough zucchini yet? Take the plant out, put a Brussels sprout over there. You don't have to grow zucchini all the way to November. If you've had plenty, you're done, fine. It's your garden. Don't let anyone make you feel guilty about taking out a zucchini plant. But you might have space for one of the-
So Don, how many zucchinis did you plant this year?
I planted 7 summer squash to try all the different-
How many people live with you in your house?
There are 5 of us out here, but there's also staff people, and I'm ready to start pulling some of those out. But actually what we did, we planted these all because I wanted to try, okay, I sell ambassador zucchini, I sell Mexican gray zucchini, I sell this. We just put them all in, see if we happen to prefer any of them. Ambassador, by the way, is very, very good. And I did some of the crookneck, and I did some of the golden ones. So it's time for some of those to just come out, and I can go ahead and put a Romanesco broccoli there. Heck, let's pivot. Let's go from summer to fall at this point. It is, yes, it is a good time to plant them. We'll get a lot of questions now about leafy greens. Lettuce, spinach, those kinds of things. They are not happy about heat. I suspect they would transplant fine this week. And if you got them in, got them established, got the plants going, heat once they're rooted in wouldn't be as much of a problem. A little shade over them could be beneficial. Spinach, lettuces, maybe shade them a little bit. The key is to keep the water on them. They're not drought tolerant, and you don't want to stress the young plants. So you might have more trouble finding the leafy greens, but the brassicas should be out there. And if you can't find them, they're on the seed rack, because most of us have switched over our seed racks for the cool season stuff, and they will germinate in, I can tell you this, about 3 days. So if you want to direct seed them, you could certainly do that now as well.
So those leafy greens, aren't they the kind of thing that will bolt when it's warm and long days?
Some do, yeah. So the bok choy, for example, which is a brassica, and the things like that will just go to flower right away. Some of the asper brock, things of that sort, the leafy forms of broccoli and kale will just almost flower right away. And also they get a little more bitter flavor. Some people like that. Some people don't mind it. Other people find it unpleasant. It's not really a warm season thing. So lettuce distinctly gets a more bitter flavor when temperatures are higher. Again, some people like that. First, when arugula and radicchio became popular, I thought these were horrible. Personally, they tasted like bad dandelions to me. Some people like dandelions. Some people like arugula. Some people like radicchio. Some people think romaine lettuce grown in late summer tastes wonderful. Most of the rest of us think it tastes somewhat bitter. It's okay to get them started. Don't be surprised if they get triggered to bloom a little bit earlier, and it will vary by variety. In my opinion, it's early for the leafy greens, but I wouldn't hesitate to try them if you got the right place. A little afternoon shade might help.
So with the if one wanted to grow leafy greens and had a spot that they could grow them in, how late in the year could you plant them? Because, I mean, this seems awfully early, but how late would you want to put them in?
You can plant spinach, lettuce, all that kind of stuff anytime, mid to late September, all the way through February.
Okay, so there's no hurry.
No.
You've got other things to do this weekend that might be more fun.
Right.
Like what are you picking these days, Don, other than zucchini?
Tomatoes, peppers, zucchini, okra, loads of okra coming in right now. So all kinds of stuff being harvested. This is harvesting and process time for the summer vegetables, but they've still got many weeks of production here. This is early to get started on this cool season stuff, but it's, you know, if you have the space, I had a guy who was having a problem. His cucumber was basically done. He wanted to know, should I feed it? Should I do this? It's got spider mites. I got plenty of cucumbers, but it's not really growing anymore. What should I do for it? And I said, well, one option is to cut it off and plant a cool season vegetable in that spot, you know, or plant another cucumber if you can find one. You still do have time in our climate for a cucumber plant or a squash plant to produce. The problem will be no nurseries aren't going to have any healthy stock in those categories at this point, very unlikely anyway. But yeah, you just go ahead and pivot, just shift over to the brassicas or something like that. Get your Brussels sprout in there. He gave me kind of a funny look when I suggested.
I'm amazed that people don't like Brussels sprouts. They're so nice.
They're bitter. They taste. Go ahead.
Brussels sprouts are wonderful if you cook them properly.
I agree.
I grew up in a household where they were boiled to mush and were terrible. And the aroma as you cooked them was like rotten eggs or something. It was it was awful. Yes. But then I discovered how to cook Brussels sprouts, and they're wonderful.
It can be. Yes, most people overcook them. My grandmother, probably like yours, mine was from Boston. And so she felt every vegetable should be cooked for at least 20 minutes. And so you literally could smash it with a fork. Yeah. It ruined a lot of vegetables for me when she would do that. But Brussels sprouts are very good when you cook them just tender. However, two things about them. They do have sulfur compounds in them, just as all members of the brassica group do. And that comes off as they're cooking. So sulfur compounds go into the air and it smells stinky. My mother would not cook Brussels sprouts indoors. My father grew them, but she would not cook them in the house. I remember her setting up a Coleman stove on the patio table to boil water and cook his Brussels sprouts for him, which she also would not eat. And the reason she wouldn't eat them is that many people taste them as bitter. They are bitter. All the brassicas have bitter compounds in them. And there's a whole thing 20, 30 years ago about so-called super tasters. More to the point, some people taste bitter more than other people do. And some people don't like the taste of bitter a lot more than other people. And so a lot of people are pretty sensitive to broccoli in particular. Cauliflower is probably the least bitter of the whole group. But Brussels sprouts have a fairly concentrated bitterness to them, which is probably exacerbated by stress, but we don't know for sure. The main thing is if you wait till winter and we've had some frost, they'll have a sweetness to them because the starch in even in the leaves and stems will convert to sugar when we get frost. So sugar will mask the bitterness, as will salt. So go ahead and cook your Brussels sprouts outside on the Coleman stove on the patio table so no one objects to the sulfur smell. And then be sure to put a nice salty sauce on them and don't overcook them. Everyone will be happy. Having said all that, someone sent us a recipe for Brussels sprouts, a shredded Brussels sprout casserole recipe. And I have it somewhere. It's delicious. If you go to redwoodbarn.com, you will see a planting chart there. And there's two versions of it. One is the fall planted things and the other is the spring planted things. And as I say, redwoodbarn.com. And you will see a lot of things going in from seed or plants at this time of year. One thing I do want to mention, if you're thinking about them, I was out taking pictures this morning. And right next to my tomatoes are some seedling wild radish. Wild radish is in brassica. It's in the mustard family. Common weed on farm areas. We have mustard and radish as very common reseeding weeds. In fact, if you kill everything out of an area one way or another, it doesn't even matter exactly how you do it, whether you mulch or tarp or spray or whatever, one of the first things it'll invade on a farm is anything in the mustard family. And on my property, it's usually these little radishes with the white flowers, which I think are fine. They don't really bother me. I just mow them and try to reduce the seed load. On the radish plants, at the end of the garden, where I'll probably be planting Brussels sprouts, were harlequin bugs. Harlequin bug is I think we talked about it a couple of weeks ago. It's a sucking pest. It's a stink bug group. And they look sort of like a ladybug if you don't know your bugs real well. Same kind of, you know, spots on them and all that kind of thing. And you tend to find them in large clusters, usually copulating freely in front of you. And they are, you know, they're a congregating type of insect. A small number of them doesn't do a lot of damage, but a large number of them on your collard plant feeding on the leaves will damage them to the point that bacterial diseases can get in and actually damage the plant pretty severely. The way you get them inadvertently on your fall vegetables is by letting them go through the summer on your brassicas. So before I plant any Brussels sprouts down at that end of the garden, Romanesco or anything in that family, I'm going to mow off the radishes. That's really all it will take. I just set my mower to about 2 inches and mow off that whole area. That'll take care of it. That'll blast them off there, send those harlequin bugs into oblivion. I don't need to kill them directly because I have scattered them freely around the property, at which point they'll be very vulnerable to birds and other predators that will come along and feed on them. But if I don't do that, if I plant collards and Brussels sprouts, we've got, you know, months before we're going to be harvesting from those, and those harlequin bugs will just move right off of the wild radish onto the brassicas, and I'll have a problem with them. So check your wild radishes, your wild mustard, or if you're a normal person, sweet alyssum, which is in that family, you might have it scattered about your yard. Look closely, look for these black and red spotted, more or less, or mottled bugs on there, and do something about them. And the simplest is just to remove the host plant. That's really all it typically takes. These are not going to fly away while you're doing things. As I mow, they're just going to get mowed. And so you'll be able to control them, but you should do that before you plant your brassicas. Don't let these members of the mustard family over summer and then reinfest your cool season vegetables.
Boy, that was a long digression, Don. Yeah. Where are we anyway? We're in Davis. And what's the radio show we're on? Davis Garden Show. That's it.
KDRT is community radio. That means public radio. We rely on contributions from listeners like you all to fund our operating costs. If you like what you hear, head on over to kdrt.org and click on the support button. And there are some other great programs on here. Let's see. There's all kinds of public affairs shows. How about Ion Sports? Eye on Sports is a talk radio show focused on local sports from the Sacramento and Davis area that occasionally covers national sports. Chuck and Cody have been involved with sports both nationally and locally for more than 15 years, share their opinions, initiate discussion to the public through conversation and occasional outside interviews. This show will not be politically driven in any way. Conversation will cover the results, local impact, business and psychology of sports. A lighthearted, focused conversation on everything sports related. Cody and Chuck, Ion Sports is live Thursday, 6 to 7 p.m. Replay Saturday morning at 7 a.m., about an hour before the Davis Garden Show replay. Okay.
So we have some messages that have come in. And Don, if you these listeners want to send us messages, where do they send it?
DavisGardenShow@gmail.com. Yeah, I do want to follow up on one. Annie, I think it was having trouble with her tomatoes. And the one thing I realized as I was listening back and editing it, I didn't really mention nematodes, I don't think. And while it didn't look from your pictures to me, Annie, like you have root knot nematode, the symptoms of those are challenging. It generally just looks like your plant needs more water when you know it basically doesn't. But I would suggest, since you have some of the plants from your picture that are further along in their decline than others, take one of those and pull it out and look at the roots and even wash the soil off the roots. Root knot nematode is very recognizable when you have it. You'll see the nodules on the root. You're sacrificing a plant to do this. So choose one that's, you know, as they say, pretty far along, and look up online what root knot nematode infested roots look like. It'll be quite apparent. I'd like you to rule that out, because we talked about it looked like they needed water. It looked like the nitrogen application that you'd been using was just not as effective as we would hope. But after answering your question, I had a couple other people come into my nursery with almost the same problem. Raised planters, got off to a great start, got some hot weather, plants got stressed, thought they were watering enough. Now, in each of their cases, we concluded they probably weren't watering enough, that the roots had not been able to make the connection through to the soil below because they were still just watering the top foot of these raised planters. And that's something to be aware of, is that you may not be getting the water deep enough. You may not, it's worth checking, as we always say, the next day after at least one irrigation to see how deep you actually got it. And in their cases, they're probably only about a foot down, which is enough to keep the plant alive, keep it going, especially when we have mild weather. Then we have a sudden spike, as we did, of a few days of above average temperatures. And both cases, their plants suddenly looked stressed. That obviously is why I focused on watering. And in their case, it was pretty clear they weren't watering long enough. So I still want you, if you haven't done it already, to do that deep soaking. I would say with the nitrogen thing, in each of their cases, I suggested they go ahead and just do a soluble liquid fertilizer, whether an organic one like fish emulsion or one of the better known, you know, popular houseplant fertilizers or something like that, just to get some fast acting nitrogen on those plants and see if they would green up quickly. Those would rule out the nitrogen deficiency and the irrigation problem. But I do want you to pull one of them out, take a close look at the roots. If you have root knot nematode, it's a whole separate conversation.
So there's not a lot of announcements to make this time. I mean, we have things coming up in the fall, but what have you got today, Don, that's current?
Okay. This is not cheerful, but there has been one human case of West Nile virus in Yolo County. Yolo County is where we are. It's a case in Woodland. Person, I believe, was hospitalized. A human case will probably trigger decision-making process that leads them to more spraying. If you're interested in that part of the topic, you can certainly go to the Sacramento YOLO Mosquito and Vector Control District. There, it trips off the tongue, doesn't it? How about just fightthebite.net?
That's a good one.
Yep. That's easier. That's fightthebite.net. You can go there, and if you happen to have intentional standing water in your backyard, like a pond or a water feature, you can get mosquito fish delivered free of charge to your home simply by going to fightthebite.net and requesting delivery. And people who have done it have told me they usually are there within like 24 hours. I'm not making any promise, but they do that. And they do that for us at our nursery because we have water plant displays. They come around very regularly. If we call them, they're typically there the next day. This is one of the simplest things they can do to try and reduce mosquito problems, is focusing on the larval stage with a natural predator of the mosquito fish. I can tell you from experience, mosquito fish will live in practically any amount of water that mosquitoes would live in. So I have ponds on my property. I put mosquito fish in them years ago, and there are plenty of them in there years later. They don't die in the winter. They go through the winter just fine here. You can get lots of information there at fightthebite.net about different ways to deal with mosquitoes. And I found a very useful little guide from our friends over at the Plant Foundry. So hold on a moment while I find it, because I thought I'd saved it, but I didn't. Here we go. Woodland resident was hospitalized for the illness, one of 18 reported statewide in humans this year in California. Yolo County is the 12th county to confirm a human infection. The most common mosquito-borne disease in California is, in fact, West Nile virus. Most people infected with West Nile virus experience mild or no symptoms. About 20% develop flu-like symptoms, and about one in 150 cases requires hospitalization or can even be fatal. So it can be devastating to a small percentage of the population. So they do start taking action. They monitor for West Nile. They have traps all over the place. They do a ground level spraying program, and they do an aerial spraying program. And if you're in Davis or Woodland, each city on their website has information about this. So cityofdavis.org, I guess it would be. And you can find information there about when they spray for the mosquitoes. It'll link you back over to fightthebite.net to read about what they're using to spray and any precautions you may need to take if they happen to do aerial spraying over residential areas. Typically, it's the rural areas outside of Davis, but of course, many people live on the edge of town near farms, so they might be experiencing overflight. Many nurseries are dealing with this question that comes into us, and this was one that came into my friends over at the Plant Foundry. Do you have the plants that keep the bugs away? We don't want you to think that planting anything in your garden, I'm saying this, not them, is going to kill, repel, or reduce mosquitoes or the risks that they carry. But there are plants that have compounds in the leaves, citronella being one of the most notable, that smell and that are known to be useful in certain ways in repelling mosquitoes. So this has turned into a thing you'll see at garden centers, particularly at the do-it-yourself chains where that's just kind of put out there by the wholesale grower. Certain highly pungent scented geraniums that smell like Lemon Pledge are being sold as mosquito plant, or Citrosa is the name that's being put on some of those. There's others. Lemon Verbena has the same compound. Citronella is a very common compound in plants that are totally unrelated to each other. Interestingly, some of my favorite garden plants, you can walk by, crush a leaf. Lemon Verbena is a good example. Smell your finger. Smells like lemon. If you rub that all over your body while you're out in the garden, it would repel mosquitoes until it all volatilizes off your skin. That is quite possibly true. Putting it in the ground or in a pot out in the garden, will that do anything to repel mosquitoes? Of course not. It's not going to make any difference whatsoever. But I hate to say this, it's being marketed and promoted, and you'll see a lot of memes on this basis. So my friends at the Plant Foundry have these ways to help fight the bite. Dump standing water regularly. Mm-hmm. Really important. Even small amounts can become mosquito breeding sites. As one who lives on a rural property and has had bowls of water out for dogs and wildlife and whatnot, I can attest to that. It doesn't take much water to get a population cycle of mosquitoes, and just turning it over, letting it fill back up once a week seems to take care of it, because it's about a 10-day life cycle. So that would be fine. Dump standing water regularly. You can use products like mosquito dunks and mosquito bits in standing water that can't be emptied, so ponds and water features, follow the label directions. But these are BT products, Bacillus thuringiensis products. Much like what you use for caterpillars, this is a different strain of BT that is specific to mosquitoes. So environmentally safe, very low toxicity to people. Read the label, but you just kind of throw a piece in the water and it seemingly magically takes care of the problem.
Would your foxes be harmed by drinking that water?
No, it's harmless to mammals, harmless to actually pretty much every other insect too. So the dragonflies landing there wouldn't be harmed by it either. Just the mosquitoes. The BT strains are very, very host specific. The one that kills caterpillars only kills caterpillars and so forth. Now here's one, and I like the way they put this. Add fragrant plants to patios and gathering areas. We have beauties like this mosquito way Eva scented geranium. Then they say, plants alone aren't a substitute for proven mosquito protection, but they're a lovely addition to the garden. True, and they do smell good. And as you crush it and put it on you, you're probably repelling mosquitoes for at least for that brief period of time. The only problem I really have is the notion that these are somehow making a significant difference in the, you know, the population of mosquitoes around. Yeah, they smell good, and they probably help when you rub them on your skin. They go on to say, use an effective personal repellent and cover up, especially around dawn and dusk, which are the feeding times for mosquitoes. And then go to fightthebite.net for more information about mosquito control so you can protect yourself, your family, and your backyard gatherings during this mosquito season. So if someone says to you, these plants are going to, you know, make a big difference, that's not just hype, that's probably misleading. But they do have compounds in them that are the ingredients in certain natural mosquito repellents. There's a whole lot of information online, most of it contradictory and confusing about whether those types of natural mosquito repellents work. I would suggest that you just try them and see. But we do know that citronella compounds in particular will have a temporarily repellent effect on some of these insects, not just by being out there, by being on you. So you can walk around smelling like lemon pledge and you won't get bitten quite as much. Or you could just confine your activities to the non-mosquito times of day, which are dawn and dusk.
You want to mention citronella candles?
Sure. There are candles that put out citronella. Same thing, same idea. You're volatilizing into the air. Presumably a mosquito flying into that cloud of citronella-laced air will be repelled and will be distracted or fly somewhere else for as long as that particular cloud of it is in their vicinity. Think about gases, though. You know, our citronella candle is going to make your patio mosquito safe if the gases, the volatile compounds are drifting around here and there. So I don't really see them as being particularly effective, but at least temporarily, right in the presence of the citronella, yes, mosquitoes and other small insects are repelled to some degree. I just don't like the overstated claims on this kind of thing. Yeah. It's really nice people coming in. I heard there's plants that repel mosquitoes because you just plant lavender by your front door and that'll keep the mosquitoes out of your house. No, that isn't the case. But they do contain the same things that are in some of the mosquito repellents that are not DEET-based. So some people don't want to use DEET. Go online, do some research at legitimate sites like, you know, .edu or places where they have nothing to sell you. They just want to give you information. And you could perhaps get more information about which of the herbal repellents actually work. And again, try them. Not everybody is equally affected by mosquitoes. In our family, I'm the one who could just stroll out there and I barely even notice them and everybody else is getting eaten alive. So they like some people more than others. We know that. That's a fact.
Okay. So from the mailbag, we have Wen Quinn's letter that says, thank you so much for answering all my shade tree selection questions last month. I have scheduled an appointment with Sacramento Tree Foundation's free tree program next week, and hopefully I'll be able to get a few columnar zelkova for the backyard and an Oklahoma redbud for the front yard. I have a few follow-up questions, if you don't mind. Mm-hmm. One, if I plant the Oklahoma redbud close to the sewer line in the front yard, can it cause sewer damage? I'm thinking of planting the tree where the circle is on the attached picture. And the is very nice. She has not only an aerial photo from Google of her house and where she's going to put the tree, but then she has from the city, she has a chart that shows all of the lines of various things, including her sewer line, which starts out at 3 feet deep where it starts at the house and ends up at 7 feet deep when it's down in the middle of the road. So where she's planning to plant this, the sewer line is about 5 feet deep.
Yeah.
Is that too shallow for
No, these are trees that don't have aggressive roots in the cases of what we're talking about. And this is a modern neighborhood, so this is not Orangeburg plumbing where you're dealing with a type of sewer line that's potentially easily invaded by roots. Those of you in older neighborhoods know what I'm talking about with that one, but this is not that. So I think you're fine. Now you've done a utility inspection, so presumably they gave you some advice on this. I don't have any problem with Oklahoma Redbud in that spot, and I don't think you're going to have any issues here. So that part I think is fine.
And the second question is, I love the multi-trunk shape of Redbud, but I'm assuming the tree I'll get from the tree foundation will have been pruned to a single trunk. Is there a way to encourage it to grow more trunks at the base? What would happen if I cut the Redbud close to the base of the trunk of the tree? What? If
Well,
I
you could,
cut the
sure.
Redbud trunk, would it die or would it sprout new lower
In other
branches?
words, the question is, can you head it back and get it to sprout? It'll sprout if you want to do that. You'll have a sort of a funny looking plant at that point because it'll just turn into a giant shrub. It won't be a multi-trunk tree. It'll be a shrub. I know this is a, there's no formal definition of shrub versus tree, but generally speaking, it has to do with the ultimate height of the plant and how many shoots are coming up from the base. So we'll talk about something with, say, three trunks. Crepe myrtles are often grown that way as a multi-trunk tree. If you took that same crepe myrtle, cut it back as is being described here, and let it flesh out, my growers would sell that as a crepe myrtle bush. Same variety being grown in a different manner. It's possible that they'll bring out natural form red bud, in which case the grower has left the lower branches. That's great. We love that. That is my preference as a retailer. When wholesalers do that, I wish we could all encourage that because that'll be a better balanced tree. You don't have to worry so much about training it, about staking them. Frequently, it isn't even necessary to stake a naturally grown tree because it has lower branches that are balancing it. It's already been reactive to the wind in the wholesale yard. It's got good enough structure. You have to make that decision on site, but you often don't have to stake a naturally grown tree. But as you know, they're probably going to bring one out that's been trained up like a tree. That's just the nature of our business and the way it goes. Is a high likelihood that at some point down the road, a bud will break and grow further down on that trunk and just come out and help to fill in and make a more natural look. If that happens, you'll encourage it. Many people would remove those lower branches, but you can certainly let that grow when it does happen. There's not an easy way to encourage that to occur. I have read of a technique where you take a razor blade and you go down and you find a bud on the stem and you take the razor blade, you very carefully cut through the cambium below the bud.
No, above the bud.
Excuse me, thank you. Yes,
Above the bud.
above the bud, because that blocks the flow of hormones down from the top of the tree. And now this bud will think, oh, there's no growing point there, blocking my growth. It will sprout and grow.
I've done
Hypothetically,
that on a fiddly fig. It worked.
It works. It doesn't harm the plant particularly. A slight injury on the bark will heal right over, even if it doesn't work. So I'm not concerned about that. So you can try that, I suppose. But more to the point, pretty good chance it'll just sprout on its own. There's a lot of plants that will definitely sprout on their own. Olives, a number of other small evergreen or deciduous trees that'll just naturally try to go back to being multi-trunk. Crepe myrtles being a classic example of that. Redbud less so, but there's certainly a possibility. Yeah, you could decapitate it if you want, but that'll give you a training issue 2 to 3 years down the road that'll be a little more complicated. I think you probably will find you like the look of it as a tree. If a lower branch comes up, great, you can encourage that.
So, about her suggestion, if she's talking about cutting the red bud down near the base of the trunk, in other words,
Somewhere, yeah.
so would it matter if I was 2 inches, 6 inches, a foot above the ground level? Would it make a difference? Would the plant recover?
I would go higher just to give you more to work with in the future. That's the only thing. But it wouldn't be my first approach. I wouldn't head a plant, the tree that's been grown this way with a single trunk. I would probably just let it grow more shoots from the main stem if it does. This is an Oklahoma redbud. This has become extremely popular in the Sacramento Valley because it is a good size for a red bud. It gets about 15 to 20 feet with equal spread, round growth habits, same beautiful flowers in the spring as the western red bud, the native one, but much more of a tree habit naturally on this. This is one of the reasons it's being used by the Tree Foundation and Tree Davis and others in lieu of the native one, is it's more like a tree. And also it doesn't get leaf burn as badly as the native one does. But the main thing is that it really naturally looks more like a tree. But they're very prunable, they're very trainable. This is something you'll be able to work with over time.
Okay, next question. For the Zelkova trees, would planting them closer than 5 to 6 feet apart help to make them grow shorter? I would like them shorter. Or would it just result in less healthy trees?
I'm a little concerned about going closer than 5 to 6 feet apart for something that really wants to become a tree. I think that would stunt them in the sense of keeping them shorter, but it also would result in less healthy trees. So the wider spacing would be my preference.
Okay. Also on the Zelkova trees, I will try using a nurseryman's spade.
Yep. We got everybody out there doing this now.
We do that. To cut a circle around the Zelkova every year to prevent, to curb the privet roots. How big should the radius of the circle be? Should it be the size of the Zelkova canopy? Larger? What?
This is just to help protect the young tree from invasion by the nearby privet roots and get it established. So for 3-4 years, you may wish to do this, where you go out about 3 feet from the trunk and just cut straight down with a nurseryman's spade to cut the roots of the privet that are coming in. Now that will also cut the Zelkova roots if they've gotten there, but they'll just branch and grow. Within 3 or 4 years, the Zelkova should be able to hold its own. So you shouldn't have to worry about it at that point, but I would start with a 3 foot radius from the trunk. If you just want a good rule of thumb, 3 to 4 foot out, cutting straight down, particularly on the side that the privets are.
And when you're planting this Zelkova, you're going to be building a circle around it, mm-hmm. so a basin. So is this outside the basin that you're cutting?
Yeah, it'll be just outside the basin, actually. Yeah.
Okay. All right. And then thank you so much. Thank you so much for helping me with all my tricky questions. I can't thank you enough for being an amazing treasure trove of information for all the gardeners around.
And then there's a follow-up question here, came in a little afterwards. When the Zelkovas are eventually tall enough and I can finally cut down the privet trees, oh, my happy day, the privets will be sandwiched in a narrow corridor between my fence and the Zelkova trees. Will the tree service be able to cut them down without knocking over either the fence or the Zelkovas? They should be able to work without damaging the Zelkovas. The fence may be an issue because one of the things we've noticed with privets and other trees that are primarily spread by birds eating the fruit and then sitting somewhere and the droppings or where the seed is it tends to be right on the fence. And sometimes with these good neighbor fences, it's literally between the part facing you and the part facing your neighbor. That can become a real problem because it's very difficult for them to get in there and cut it and treat it to prevent resprouting. It'll be challenging, but I think they're less likely to do any harm to the Zelkovas than to the fence. So the sooner you can get them cut down, the better, the less of a hassle this will be. And then you will need to work to prevent them from resprouting. Privets have about a 2 to 3 year will to live. And so you'll have to keep after those suckers that keep coming up. There are treatments you can use if they can possibly grind them out, great. But I seriously doubt if they'll be able to grind out the stumps in this situation because of the logistics. So my guess is they'll be cutting and treating, or you of course can take some time to dig out the stumps if you're so inclined. Having done that myself, you can guess it'll take you about 4 to 6 hours per stump, depending on the size and location. So it might be simpler just to deal with it by the more traditional remedies.
Okay. So, we're going to talk about spotted ring Drosophila. You know, we get these downers sometimes.
Yeah,
Intersperse
them with fun stuff if we can.
Yeah.
The question was, let me pull up that particular question here.
The question says, I've heard cherry trees are no longer recommended for this area, primarily due to Drosophila flies. Googling them, it looks like they are a pest for almost all stone fruit. So I'm guessing no peach trees, etc. either? What?
Yeah, good question, because it is true that the spotted wing Drosophila, the reason we at our nursery have stopped selling cherry trees, one of the reasons that cherries have become a higher input crop in California, can go to any soft fruit. Where this insect comes from in Japan, it is known to be a pest of not just cherries, but peaches and nectarines and plums and even persimmons. But it has a crucial upper temperature for reproduction. Mm-hmm. Saves us here. Above about 82 to 85 degrees, the males become sterile. They're incapable of mating effectively, shall we say. Most fruit flies attack softened fruit. This one ovipositors earlier in the fruit ripening cycle. So you don't have to have soft, squishy fruit. It can get it earlier on when it starts to turn color. So we know two things about spotted wing Drosophila. One is it's very strongly attracted to red fruit. When it first showed up, people with red cherries who also had Rainier or one of the white or pale pink cherries found that it got on the Bing and the other red cherries way faster and way more thoroughly, like 100% fruit infestation, than on the lighter colored ones. That doesn't prove to be a management strategy, but it did show that they have a strong preference for the red fruit. The first thing they were found on in California was red raspberries, where they did a lot of damage in the Watsonville area. Then they moved into the cherry producing area just 50, 60 miles inland, in the Stockton region, and they hit the red cherries there. They can go on blackberries, but it's rare. They can go on strawberries, but it's uncommon. You should perhaps, if you're concerned about it, pick your strawberries, float them in a bowl of water, see what happens. But they don't typically go to fruit that isn't red unless there's a very high population pressure. More to the point, you start getting to the mid-80s, the males become sterile, they can't reproduce anymore, so their season is over for us by the end of May. So our problem here is any fruit that ripens before, let's say, June, before we start getting into the 90s on a regular basis. Anything that ripens April or May can be a problem. They could even get on blueberries, but it hasn't been an issue. They typically go to the red colored fruit. And if you happen to have blueberries nearby, you might have a problem with them. But more commonly, it's just going directly to the cherries or the red raspberries. You in the Sacramento Valley, interior Southern California, most areas in California where we're growing stone fruits and things like that, we don't have to worry about them getting onto the other types of crops. Even early peaches have not had a problem with them. So it's typically just the cherries and the red raspberries. I don't sell red raspberries to begin with because I simply don't think they do well here. I have not had good results myself, and most of my customers have also not had good results with red raspberries. And then cherries, we've just stopped selling them. If you want to grow this, you need to be aware that it'll take 3 to 5 pesticide applications as the fruit is ripening to control spotted wing Drosophila. And if you don't do that, most of the fruit will have worms in it. So that's kind of your situation. I have people who want to grow them by some other method, by growing dwarfer types on a dwarfing rootstock and covering them. That works. If you want to go to that trouble, sure, you can wrap a branch. You know, if you already have a cherry tree, you don't want to take it out, you can wrap a branch before the fruit turns color with, say, frost blanket or seedling blanket, and just hold it on there with clothespins. That'll keep them out. You'll get at least that branch full of uninfested fruit. But other than that, they're really a hassle to get good fruit on here in the valley.
Hi, Lois and Don. I love growing fennel, and I'm getting my seeds ready for a fall planting. I just read on the seed packet that fennel is allelopathic and should not be planted in a shared bed. It gave a special warning against companion planting with beans and members of the nightshade family, like tomatoes, eggplants, or peppers. Wouldn't you know, this beautiful flowering fennel I'm currently having exploding in bloom is sharing a bed with tomatoes, eggplants, peppers, and beans. The plants growing closest to the fennel are looking a little scruffy. I originally thought they were naturally petering out at the end of the season, but the celebrity tomatoes and Marconi pepper at the other end of the bed are dominating. For similar discussions in past episodes, I've gotten the impression from Don that true allelopathicness, is that a word?
Allelopathic, yeah.
Is more fiction than fact. What gives? Should I sequester my fennel moving forward? For reference, I'm gardening in Dixon.
Yeah. So the fennel will scatter itself very happily. Fennel seed is used by some people. A lot of people like the flowers. All kinds of beneficials like them. These are in full bloom. And these are in planters. Allelopathy is one of those slightly controversial topics. It's been observed by naturalists and savvy gardeners and even botanists and such over the years as a phenomenon. We've seen it. I've tried to plant Abelia Edward Goucher under my walnut tree a couple different times, and it just gets anemic and dies. It doesn't grow. That is not a definitive study on the subject. That's me observing it. And that's been for 2,000 years. People have been observing the impact of walnuts. It's probably the best known allelopathic plant in the world. It is known that they put a substance in the soil from the roots, and they put a substance in the soil from, in the case of walnuts, the hulls and the leaves. Fennel presumably is exuding a substance into the soil from the roots and probably from the leaves when they're decomposing on the ground, but much less of a factor perhaps than with walnuts, where you literally get several inches of leaves every year. We've all observed it. We've observed that certain plants do and certain plants don't grow under walnuts. Here's the problem. Take any two lists that you'll find. And you'll find these online. Extension publications have done these lists of plants that can grow under black walnuts and plants that can't, plants that can grow under English walnuts. And they don't correspond. You'll find plants on the one list that are not on the other, and so on. These are just observations in different places of the impact of walnuts or pecans or hickories, they also have the same compound, on the plants underneath them. Dr. Linda Chalker Scott up at Washington State, this is one of her garden myths that she takes on, is allelopathy. It is way, and she says this and I agree with her, I'm paraphrasing her, it's way overstated. The implication is that if there's a walnut tree somewhere in your backyard, nothing's going to grow. Plants are going to die near it. But there's loads of pictures, and many of us have, you know, experience growing things under and near walnut trees that do just fine. And some of them are things around lists that they shouldn't be doing just fine. Digging deep into this, it was pretty easy to find that anything, including things like juglo, that go into the soil will be broken down at a rate by soil bacteria that are present, that is determined by the temperature and the moisture, the, you know, the biological activity of that soil. So in areas like this where we're in agricultural soil, that's really good, really has lots of bacterial activity, lots of mycorrhiza down there that are living on roots, lots of things that are breaking down substances that come into the soil. Any input that goes in, there's something that's in there that'll increase in number, some bacteria that will just break it down. And we know that juglone breaks down actually pretty quickly. Real question that came up at one point was, I had a walnut, it was taken out, how long do I, quote, have to wait, end quote, to plant something else? Well, the juglone was pretty much not even measurable a year later in the soil in that particular study that I looked at. So it does break down reasonably quickly. That's a walnut tree. And what she would point out is a walnut has got roots everywhere. It's got shade. It's using a lot of water. It's they couldn't separate out the impact of juglone, the substance, from just the competition from the tree. Giant walnut on my property, I find roots 20, 30, 40 feet out from the drip line of that tree with no problem. So it's definitely mining water and nutrients from all around it. And as she would point out, a lot of what they're seeing as plants don't grow under walnuts could simply be, and has never been systematically studied in this regard, competition from the walnuts. You get a solid stand, an orchard of walnuts, not much grows under them at all, because just from the trees themselves, shading things out and out competing them. This is a different issue than fennel. Fennel is presumably just putting a toxin in the soil. And what they typically will do when they first want to study allelopathy is they'll take the extract, the juglone, for example, from the walnut, or in the case of the fennel, they'll take an extract from the root and they'll use it in greenhouses. And they'll do studies about whether they inhibit germination of seeds. This is one of the most clearly defined, clearly observed impacts of allelopathy, is it the suppression of annuals from seed. And that's sort of a starting point to see whether there's something in this plant that might be affecting the growth of things underneath it. And in fact, they made an ethanol extract, alcohol, from the dried fruit of fennel, the seed, and then they used it in greenhouses in carefully measured amounts to see whether it would affect the germination of, they used perennial ryegrass, barley, oat, and dandelion. And all the concentrations of this substance derived from the fennel seeds suppressed the germination of the ryegrass and the dandelion. It significantly reduced the germination of the oats and suppressed the seedling growth, and particularly the higher rates, and the effect on wild barley was significant, but decreased. It was less affected than the other plants. So here we have an extract from fennel that was used that suppressed the growth of annuals. So if you want to not have annuals growing in there, fennel might be fine, but that was an extract from the seeds. How field realistic is that in terms of the effect of fennel in your garden? It's not. So we don't think that the fennel is going to have a significant effect on the plant, except for looking at your picture here. It's 4 feet tall. It's branching rather heavily as it flowers. It's clearly shading out the beans. And I would guess if you dumped that out and did a sort of a root volume analysis, you'd find that the fennel has a lot more roots in there than the beans do. So I see competition as being likelier here than actual allelopathy. More to the point, fennel is one of these wonderful plants that you can allow to scatter itself outside of your boxes. Once those seeds come down, it'll pop up in any crack in the bricks. It'll pop up behind the box and make a nice big plant over there. So it's a very compatible plant in a vegetable garden. I wouldn't put it right in the planter next to another thing, simply because of, in my opinion, the root competition and the fact that it'll grow taller and shade out the plant. I'm guessing you wouldn't have a problem with corn, for example, or sunflowers if you planted fennel with them. But yes, your beans, your smaller tomatoes could have an impact. So I don't think your fennel is a big problem. I just think that filling one planter with it made it hard for you to grow beans in that particular situation.
And Rachel ends with a bonus just for fun. I was tickled when Don mentioned his genuine tomato as a front runner last week. Mine is twice the size of its bodacious tomato neighbor and has given more huge tomatoes on one plant than any I have ever had.
Yeah.
This one has earned a permanent place in my tomato lineup.
I first planted genuine, it turned out, from my notes in 2016 when it kind of first came on the market, and I gave it good marks at the time and then moved on. This year, it is going to be one of my top two or three performers. I've already picked 30 at least from that plant. There's another 40 on there easily. So it's keeping pace with those early girl and the new girl and the others. It's a big, beautiful fruit, and it's great all purpose. It slices. I mean, I'm really, really impressed with this one. I can tell you the year-end tomato wrap-up, when I do this with Farmer Fred on his show, we'll definitely be talking genuine and Jet Star. And one, just a little foreshadowing here, Haleana, which is a Hawaiian word. Haleana, I think I got the name right. It's I always tell friends and family who are traveling, they'll say, oh, we're going to Hawaii. What should we bring you? And I always say the same thing, pack of seeds. Just go buy a packet of seeds wherever you are. Tomatoes best if you can, but whatever else you find is fine. So a friend of mine 2 years ago went to Hawaii. Haleana tomato, which is a Hawaiian specialty variety, was on the seed rack, so she brought us a pack of seeds, and it's turning out to be a phenomenal producer in this area. More details on that one later, but genuine, definitely a front runner this year.
All right, so we're back to the depressing thing. There's a new pest, and this is from Southern California on eucalyptus, it's called, are you ready for this? The dotted peropsony leaf beetle.
I'm going to go with peropsine is my best guess on that, but who knows? Could be peropsine. This beetle was found feeding on lemon-scented gum, one of my favorite of the smaller eucalyptus group, in Los Angeles in August 2022, okay, 4 years ago. That was the first report of the beetle in North America. It has quickly spread throughout Southern California. It can be found in Los Angeles, Orange, San Diego, and San Bernardino counties, with unconfirmed reports in Ventura County. It has a broad host range, feeds on over 20 eucalyptus and carimbia species, including the ones most commonly found in California, the cider gum, the red gum, the blue gum, the silver dollar gum, sugar gum, and the lemon-scented gum. The first three or four that I mentioned are the very big ones that you see all over coastal and Southern California. If we really hit, and it is hitting, if it really hits those species hard, there's going to be a lot of defoliation. A lot of those trees will become unsafe, possibly. There's going to be a lot more maintenance involved, and there's generally not an easy management. But if you're in Southern California, because that landmass, just those four counties I started with, is a significant chunk of Southern California. If your eucalyptus tree is getting eaten, look for a beetle. If you find the beetle, contact your local county ag commissioner's office. I think they would be interested to know that it's there.
Well, today I wanted to read you a quote from Henry David Thoreau. This is a naturalist and a philosopher who lived back in the 1800s. And he said, I have great faith in a seed.
You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore
and Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.